Born ready.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for joining us here on Bitcoin Study Sessions. We are incredibly honored today to have with us a key contributor and the editor of the Satoshi Papers, Reflections on Political Economy After Bitcoin. This is Natalie Smolinski. She is a first-generation American of Polish descent, a Texan by birth, and she had previously pursued a PhD focusing on value with a specific emphasis on the sacred, and left that in order to join the startup world in business development, working with Bitcoin directly for verification of identity and credentials, and has become truly a thought leader in the space, reminding us of the inherent rights that we have as individuals and the liberties that we're born with that have been subsumed by state actors in the current world. Where we go today, Grant and I have some questions that that we'd like to ask Natalie about her work, and we just finished going through the Satoshi Papers together and reading through every chapter and discussing those. And so it really is an honor to have Natalie with us today to talk about this. But before we get started, Natalie, first off, did I miss anything in that introduction? Is there any corrections? And then the first question that I have for you is, what is the interesting thought that is going through your mind right now? What are the things that you're working on that you find intriguing in the world today?
First of all, thank you so much for both the generous introduction and for having me on your show. There aren't a lot of people who read your book cover to cover, and certainly not a lot of people who record separate podcasts on each chapter. So I really wanted to honor the work that you guys put into this volume, and, you know, take the time with you that you had taken with the book. So thank you for that. You didn't miss anything in the intro. I would say, you know, these days I'm thinking a lot about social theory. So in the Satoshi Papers, the chapter that I authored on the theory of money was kind of bringing together anthropology and economics. I've been looking more, at psychology recently and, political philosophy. And political theory.
Okay.
No, that's great, because we have questions about both of those. The psychological aspect of your theory of anthropological theory of money, and also just where you're, not to get ahead of ourselves, but where all of your thinking in this is situated in kind of the political, current contemporary discourse politically. But before we get there, so one of the cool things about the Satoshi Papers is the framing device. So it's like the Federalist Papers is the model, right? So it's based on that, the dialogue that our founders had at the founding as to what type of nation we should be, what our principles were, what type of common project we were embarking on. And so that's what I'm, like, the first question, I'm just curious as to that framework. It seems like there's two centers of gravity that are like pulling, the essays are pulled towards those. One is, again, modeled after the Federalist Paper, wanting to kick off a dialogue. Our nation used to have a common project built around inalienable rights of sovereign individuals, but now we kind of have an authoritarian consensus that's developing through what you call the Bankers' Revolution after that, with the uniting of money and state power. That's one center of gravity. And the other one is, like, Bitcoin is this technology that has certain characteristics. It's a protocol. It's a bunch of things. So how do those two things go together? And, like, is Bitcoin a necessary part of this picture? Like, we're talking about a refounding, and then Bitcoin is just another technology out there, right? Or is it some essential aspect of what you see as this potential refounding, this potential project we're embarking on now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that the American project, the early American project, is historically unique in that it served as an attempt to elaborate both a theory and a practice of the state in which the power of the state is limited, limited from the get-go. And this is what the Federalist, Anti-Federalist debate was all about, is, you know, where are we going to draw limits to the power of the state? And what the founders accomplished was a kind of inversion of the theory of the state, where rather than, you know, the traditional view or the consensus view that rights flow from the state and the individual is downstream from the state, downstream from law, downstream from community, the founders inversed that. They placed the individual upstream from all of those things. And so the totality of rights, enumerated and unenumerated, belong to the individual. And then it is only the enumerated rights, explicitly enumerated in the Constitution, that belong to the state. And those rights are delegated. Those are not those, I shouldn't even say rights, I'm sorry, powers. So the state is given powers by rights-bearing individuals. And those powers of the state are limited. The individual in the American Republic is always in the position to revoke delegation of powers to any government, whether state or local or federal. And so this was really historically innovative. It was unprecedented. And of course, it was challenged right from the start. And in fact, some historians, like, you know, Murray Rothbard, for example, you know, they've made the argument that in effect, the Constitution itself was a capitulation to a state trending toward unlimited power. And so that's always the historical trend. The state always tends toward unlimited power. And the question is, can we build political communities and frameworks that arrest that kind of teleology of the state?
And so do you agree that the Constitution was a capitulation? Do you think that any sort of political organization, so like Rothbard's an anarchist, is that right? I mean, would be opposed to the state as such, but that doesn't seem to be the project of the Satoshi papers necessarily. It doesn't seem to be anarchist in character, but more so like what types of laws do we need to have to recenter us onto an individual rights focused framework? Is that right?
So I don't like political labels in general, you know, anarchist or otherwise, because they do a lot of work, and too much work. They produce false knowledge about, you know, what we think we might know about, you know, someone labeled in these ways. I would suggest that the Bitcoin Project, which is the central project of this book, is a practical attempt to once again make the individual sovereign in a meaningful way, that is over their financial resources and their economic transacting. So it is a outworking of a theory of the individual as, again, upstream from politics, upstream from law. Now, whether or not that's an anarchist position, I don't know.
Right.
But it's the Bitcoin position. And, you know, I think the question of Constitution is like, we're already far downstream from the individual. So we have groups of individuals coming together to decide together on a framework of government and what the limits of the powers of government shall be. I don't know if there's any other way, honestly, for a political community to self-govern. That said, the limits on government power cannot be entrusted to the government itself to enforce. In other words, no social institution can be trusted to police itself. This is why the Enlightenment posited the separation of powers as critical, as a critical defense against tyranny. Now, you know, one could argue that if you separate powers within an entity that is the government, so legislative, judicial, and executive branches of the federal government, you still have the federal government policing itself at the end of the day. And so what is, in fact, the meaningful check on the power of the state? Well, the individual, the power of the individual. And so by empowering the individual, what the Bitcoin protocol does is make manifest in practice a limit to the power of the state.
Yeah, so you can, I just got back from living in Malaysia near Singapore and, you know, interfacing with a lot of locals there. I would say that I generously describe Singapore as a mall inside of a prison, and Malaysia to a certain extent as well. And then I come back to the United States and I see these same degradation of personal liberty and, you know, the ability to conduct anything private. And you talk about this in the epilogue very directly. You know, all freedoms stem from the individual. Let's not pretend that the state has any rights. Mm-hmm. Rights are something that we've really abused that word because especially in the United States now, we have so many rights that are granted to certain classes of individuals or certain groups of individuals in order to placate. And I think this is something that's in like the fourth turning where it's like basically the government will take your freedom and exchange, they'll give you rights, and they'll take your liberties and exchange, they'll give you rights. But you come at this from the perspective of the rights can't be given because they're something that are inherent, that we're born with. And so kind of to follow up on Grant's question, do you think that the founding fathers would recognize the world that we live in today in the United States as even a cousin or a distant relative of what they intended to create? Or have we, as a result of the Bank Secrecy Act and the Banker's Revolution, have we just gotten so far off course that what we need is this refounding in order to bring us back? And the only thing that can do that is the enumeration of those rights through code.
Yeah. I think the current American empire would be unrecognizable to the founders. That, you know, that may or may not be a good thing. The important thing is less, I think, how the founders might feel about America today, as the ability of the Republic to adhere to the principles that outlined and demarcated the American project. So the interesting thing about principle is that it can manifest in many different ways. So there's not one cultural form that embodies a principle once and for all. You know, it, this means that. And so this is why liberty and and concepts of natural rights or inherent rights are universal, can be universal because they don't belong to any one place or time. And this is what gives human societies the ability to and the freedom to change and evolve over time while, you know, still maintaining their essential character as principled projects.
Okay.
So to bounce off from a couple of things you said, you referenced the Bitcoin position, and in the introductory essay that you write that kind of provides a framework for the rest of the anthology, you note that there's kind of a set of maybe assumptions that are shared by the authors. I think maybe, let's see if this is maybe the Bitcoin position. You write that respect for the freedom and privacy of the individual is the bedrock of a just and prosperous society, that power should be rigorously checked and limited, that human coordination happens first and foremost from the bottom up, and that technology in the broadest sense is a critical engine for the progress of humanity. So that's, I think that's a statement of kind of what the Bitcoin position is in the context of discussing what a refounding might look like. And so I'm curious then, and kind of cognizant of your, admonition that we shouldn't label political views and then just look at the label and forget kind of the whole discourse around them. But where does the Bitcoin position fit into kind of current political dialogue? And just to throw out a couple, there's the idea of call it dark enlightenment, neo-reaction, Curtis Yarvin and Nick Land, the idea that a better framework for governance is like a CEO model where people, constituents are almost like shareholders in a corporation. Democracy is kind of minimized in a sense. And the enlightenment itself is kind of looked upon maybe as an unfortunate occurrence. And we proceed forward on this moving forward technologically in the mode of a CEO-driven startup or something like that. On one hand, maybe you could say that's the right, and then the left, to use inadequate labels again, something like Ezra Klein's abundance view, where maybe strong federal government that deregulates enough to allow innovation but still allows kind of a fundamental guiding role for innovation. Those both seem very authoritarian. The Bitcoin position seems substantively different from that. Is that, I guess, how would you situate the Bitcoin position in this kind of roiling political discourse we find ourselves in?
Yeah, no, I think you raise a really good point, which is that the normative political horizon for both, let's say, the right and the left in quotation marks today is fundamentally statist and authoritarian. So, you know, fashionable political theorists are arguing about, you know, who should lead the state? What should the state do? What is the mandate of the state? You know, what are the characteristics of the state? Blah, 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 state. Whereas, you know, Bitcoin is, you can call it atheistic with regard to the state. It doesn't care if there is a state or there's not a state, or what kind of state it is, or how many states there are, or if it's an empire, or if it's a republic, or if, you know, if there's a CEO in charge, or a king, or anyone else. Bitcoin is a non-state protocol. And so what it does, though, is because it's a non-state form of money, it immediately relativizes one of the justifications that defenders of the state use for the state, which is, well, if we don't have states, who's going to issue our money and who's going to manage our money? Well, the Bitcoin answer is that money arises bottom up from individuals who perceive something to be of value and then standardize that unit into a medium of exchange and a unit of account. And this has a very long historical record, a very long anthropology. The first so-called repeatable objects that were used in a money-like fashion, these were not state-issued. They did not rely on the state in any way for their value, circulation, or management. And so the issuance and management of money is a function that the state captured and monopolized at a certain point in human history to serve itself primarily, to serve its primary function, which is making war. You know, I'm very convinced of the conquest theory of the state. The state is an instrument of organized violence, first and foremost, and all of its other functions are downstream from that. Whereas money is a value phenomenon that is first and foremost bottom up. And so Bitcoin is just a reminder of that. Like, and it raises the question necessarily, if we don't need the state for money, then what else do we not need the state for that we may think we need the state for today?
Yeah. So you basically just don't accept the premise of the question, you know, which I think is, I believe is correct as well. I'm going to ask you two questions just because I need to get them out of my head. So if you repeat them, fine. But one, in the epilogue, you talk about, which you're the first person that I've ever heard talk about this. We usually talk about, money arose because of the non-coincidence of wants. We were just bartering the baker and the brewer and the butcher, et cetera, et cetera. We were just handing off meat for bread and eggs, et cetera. But you make the case that this sort of awkward exchange could not have occurred, that there was actually something of value that we passed between us that enabled barter, such that if I read it correctly, basically what I hear you saying is that money preceded barter. And you can correct me if I'm wrong there. And then my other question is that you're talking about bottoms up. And so I want to get your take on if Bitcoin is a bottoms up thing, what do we think about the strategic Bitcoin reserve and what do we think about Bitcoin treasury companies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's start with the theory of barter. So, or the practice of barter, rather. I think that there's been a kind of red herring in social theory and economics and anthropology and other sciences, just social sciences to some extent, over this question of, you know, what came first, money or barter. They are two fundamentally different modes of exchange, and they have different social constraints. So if you're bartering, what you're talking about is direct exchange. You know, I have X, you have Y. We have somehow come to an agreement that my quantity of X is equal to and worth your quantity of Y, and we are going to now make a direct exchange. That type of exchange is very difficult to make.
Account, right?
Right, because there is no mediating unit of account. It's direct, you know, like for like, or between two fundamentally unlike commodities or services or whatever. And so this is Adam Smith's point when he's talking about when he says that the trade of goods must have been very much clogged and embarrassed before the use of money, because it's so hard to come to that coincidence of wants, where I want what you have to sell exactly that in exactly the quantity that you want to sell it, and then you want to buy exactly what I have to sell. in exactly the quantity that I have to sell it. And so most barter in the historical and anthropological record is, first of all, it's not a frequent occurrence. And second of all, it tends to be a collective act where you have, you know, a group of tribesmen or merchants coming together with trading partners in modes of ritualized exchange. And actually, David Graeber describes this in the context of Australian Aboriginal tribes very well. And so it's a kind of ritual. You can't scale that. You can't scale it effectively. And so you can't have a commercial society, a society in which the division of labor is becoming increasingly specialized and the profit motive is directing investment and you have entrepreneurial, you know, capitalism. You can't have that if barter is your primary mode of exchange. And so the advent of money is that it enables a commercial society. And that's the process that Adam Smith was describing. That's the process that he was living amidst. There was still barter. So money doesn't do away with barter. It just makes the vast majority of transactions much easier and cheaper.
Yeah, so I grew up, well, we actually both grew up on farms in Kansas, and barter is such a common occurrence. I help you work cows today, and tomorrow you're going to help me move hay bales. And
right.
We'll figure out the exchange that is fair. But to your point, we have to have some sort of like unit of account or something to measure that against in order to, as you say, like commercialize that transaction and bring it into somewhat of a popular mode. So then the other question I have is about the Strategic Bitcoin Reserve and Bitcoin treasury companies. So how does this fall in with the idea of bottoms up adoption of Bitcoin and also bottoms up kind of I would say expression of rights?
Well, you know, states are always seeking to acquire valuable resources. So, if anything, the drive by governments to accumulate Bitcoin is simply an acknowledgement that it's a store of value, from their point of view. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't say anything about the philosophy underpinning peer-to-peer exchange.
There was a question I had. You mentioned Adam Smith and the role that he kind of played in sorting out that misunderstanding regarding the relation of barter and the historical factual nature of whether there was a moment when there was an inadequate ability to exchange, they invent money or something like that. Another part, in your essay towards an anthropological theory of money, your awesome contribution to Satoshi papers, you're discussing Adam Smith's like theory of moral sentiments, or noting that like his theory is based on a moral sentiment. And when you're elaborating your theory, one thing that really struck me, and this struck me as novel too, and you know, you're much more read on this, so maybe it's not a novel contribution, but you write in your essay, money in all its forms is the ever-evolving social answer to the question of what people want in settlement of debts. And you make the really interesting, and for me, novel observation that money is a psychological phenomena about being satisfied that a debt has been satisfied, that a debt has been settled, rather. And so it's what we look at money kind of rationally as like, you know, we talk about the set of characteristics an object might need to have to be considered as money, but really it all reduces back to the psychological response we have to the thing. Like money is our psychological interface with value or something like that. I don't know if that's, I guess my first question, if that kind of back and forth summary is correct. And then also then if the process of Bitcoin's monetization is some sort of like psychological reconciliation process for people coming to be satisfied to receive Bitcoin in a way that's deeply relevant to their acknowledgement of the release of a debt.
Right. Yeah. So one of the things that I was trying to do in this paper was differentiate between the social process of payment and the social process of settlement, which are often treated as synonymous in the economic literature. And my point was that the process of payment is simply the process of rendering a payment. You know, I can render you a payment of 100 counterfeit dollars. And I may not know that they are counterfeit. I may believe genuinely in good faith that this is real money, but you know they're counterfeit. And so from my point of view, I've made a payment, but you have not accepted that payment. And so settlement has not occurred. And it's that process of final settlement, of the acceptance of payment by the creditor, that is the missing link to, you know, a lot of these theories of money. This is why money cannot simply be a creature of law, as the Chartalists contend, because the law defines settlement as a legal moment. But it has nothing to say about the subjectivity, the psychological state of the creditor who's accepting a payment. So this is what that case of the mixed monies in early Jacobean England illustrated so well, where two merchants entered into a contract. And, you know, after a certain period of time, one of them was due to pay the other a certain sum. But in the middle of the contract period, there was a rebellion in Ireland. And in punishment, the British crown devalued the Irish currency. Well, the contract was denominated in that Irish currency. The creditor refused to accept the payment and insisted that the contract was not fulfilled, because now the payment was worth half of what it had been worth when the contract was entered into. But the law, the Privy Council, stated explicitly that the law cannot enforce the value of money. It can only enforce the face value of the contract. So in other words, the law has something to say about payment, but it cannot have anything to say about settlement. And it is the widespread dissatisfaction of creditors in a society, people who believe something is owed to them, that there are debts that have not been paid. That is what contributes to the delegitimization of institutions and social unrest over time.
It's like perfectly sums up, I feel like, every retiree's feeling about Social Security.
Yeah.
You're fulfilling the contract, but I'm definitely not satisfied. I don't believe that you've settled the debt that you owed to me, given what we contributed.
Right.
I want to change direction a little bit. You had a fantastic Twitter exchange with Balaji Srinivasan, who I worked with when I was at the Network State, and I was there at the time. Actually, it was on a Thursday afternoon. We were having lunch, and I went over to him. I was like, "Dude, I saw that you talked with Natalie Smolin," because we had just like recorded maybe like chapter 5 or something like that, and I kind of asked him about the exchange, and I think I want to give a little background here. So Network State, for those people listening that don't know, is basically the idea that the church state fell because the printing press democratized information to the point that the church could no longer control it, and nation states arose. And the theory is that nation states will fall because the internet democratized information such that nation states cannot control it. And the outgrowth of that will be the network state, which is a group of individuals who share values that first get together in the cloud and then second come together to join and have land and create their own sovereign nations. And there are examples of this. In fact, I believe at your startup, you worked with the Republic of Malta, which is one that Balaji actually references quite often when talking about how new countries can arise, that if you get enough motivated individuals that have enough funding and then they have the land that you can create new countries. And if you look at the map over the last 70, 80 years, there's actually been quite a few new countries that have popped up. And so I really wanted to hear kind of what are your, Grant and I were talking about this last night, is that the framing of this book, in that it is a head nod towards the Federalist Papers, it does presuppose a nation state. It does presuppose that there will be this state. And so what do you think about this theory of network states and where we go? And specifically, I guess, if you want to address the project that is going on in Malaysia with the network state, because you raised what I thought were some pretty good points about the direction that the network state is moving in.
In outline, I'm familiar with Balaji's theory of the network state. I think it's great that he's actually thinking through these questions, especially in such a public way. I think he's helping a lot of people think about them. And he's done a lot of legwork to, you know, get the conversation started about different forms of political community. That said, what I find actually missing in the network state is a theory of the state. What is the state? He acknowledges that historically, a state has been a territorial entity with a physical geography and a, you know, at least aspiration to monopoly on the use of force, legitimate use of force within that territory. He doesn't, I don't think he fully takes seriously or appreciates the role that violence plays in the state. In fact, I would suggest that that violence is the essence of the state. That if you don't have a military, a police apparatus, and a legal framework that you can defend with physical force, with kinetic violence, I don't think you're a state. that's my question, is like, are you trying to build a state? Or are you trying to just build a community of purpose? And we've had communities of purpose as long as humanity has existed. And some of them are very well capitalized. Those are themselves different from businesses, from commercial enterprises, from firms, whether, you know, we're talking about a startup or a lifestyle business or a publicly traded company. These are all very different social forms. They have different objectives. They're solving for different things. And so they evolve differently over time. The main question I have for the network state as a project is like, are you sure you're trying to be a state or are you trying to be something else?
There were definitely those of us that were like, hey, you know, let's arm this place. Let's get some cannons. Let's get some. No, and I do think that you're right. I mean, to me, the best definition of a state that I've ever heard of, or is the responsibilities of a state, is to define and enforce the borders, because if you don't have borders, then you're not a country, and to define and enforce property rights within the country. And both of those require violence. Both of those require force. And so the way that you make this point, I think, is absolutely correct, is that without violence, and I think you're right. Yeah, the state is merely an apparatus of legalized violence. That is, concessions are made, are granted, powers are granted by the people in order to give the ability for the state to express those to defend those borders and defend those property rights through the use of violence. I think that's a fantastic and a very well thought out point.
But does the Bitcoin position change that, though?
Yeah.
The Bitcoin position. So you mentioned, and I'm not familiar with this theory and its substance, the warring state theory, I guess, that the purpose of the state is to conduct war, the state's conquer, mm-hmm. something like that. I mean, some of the Bitcoiners will say, you know, that's fueled by fiat currency. Take the fiat away from the conquering state. You no longer have a state that conquers. There's some equation of violence that changes with strong cryptography as well. Generally, our identities, our bodies are becoming more and more digital. And so a state, we define it maybe in relation to our physical bodies, but there's a kind of a dualism where you can have almost all of your life conducted in this immaterial realm that's protected by strong cryptography, which is immune to state violence. I mean, is there some, maybe like the network state position is in part to argue that, see, yes, you're correct about the state. It always has been fueled by violence, but the state is an antiquated conception now that we have this new digital realm in which we live the majority of our lives.
Just to tag onto that, like that would be kind of an extension of what we talked about when we looked at Jason Lowry's work with software, which he took from like Nikola Tesla, envisioning that the future of humanity is war that is fought by human out of the loop intelligent machines, which would be Bitcoin miners. And so, and we've seen this, that the returns to violence are continuously falling to the point that we now have Bitcoin, where throughout all of history, I could put a gun to your head, or I could beat you with a club, and I could threaten you and I could take what you had, or I could beat you and kill you and take what you had. But now I can threaten you and I can take your Bitcoin if you acquiesce. But if I go to the ends of killing you, then nobody gets your Bitcoin. and so, yeah, like what role does Bitcoin have to play in the future of violence?
Yeah. So that's a fantastic question. So we talked earlier about final settlement, the creditor accepting that a debt has been paid. Often that has occurred through interpersonal violence, where the debtor and the creditor could not agree on the value of a debt. Let's say the debtor has rendered payment that's not satisfactory to the creditor. Well, the debtor may show up with weapons, or, you know, with all their cousins, or, you know, their military allies, and be like, this is good, right? Yes, it's good. And so you have settlement through superior force.
Right.
Yeah.
What the Bitcoin blockchain enabled is an independent register of settlement for any transaction that occurs on chain. So it has taken what was previously a mode of social violence and automated it through cryptography and code. So that's extraordinary. And we're talking about violence, we're talking about interpersonal violence, but we're also talking about the violence of the state. So, you know, one of the elements of like contract theory of the state you know, coming out of, for example, John Locke's work, is this notion that we need the state to resolve disputes. We need the state to be an impartial party that can, you know, get to, that can help its constituents or members get to settlement. And then through violence, through the violence of the law, enforce that settlement. But it's always rooting into violence. Like, that is the settlement of the political. That is the settlement of the social, often. And so what the blockchain is doing is it's just saying, let's take this process that has been highly subjective, where, you know, you can have people of very different point of views, in effect, through superior force, forcing settlement. Now we have a genuinely impartial protocol that doesn't care who you are, doesn't care how much money is being settled, is going to apply the same rules to the process of settlement for everyone. That automates one of the functions of the state. And that also serves as an impartial way for individuals to resolve disputes. And this is something Aaron Daniel points out in his essay for the Satoshi Papers, is dispute resolution without the state. And the fact that the blockchain controls the dispersal of funds means that you no longer need, you know, the cops to show up at your house and, you know, confiscate your stuff or, you know, take your property in settlement of a court judgment. There could be, you know, smart contract processes that automatically transfer funds on a blockchain in an irrevocable way. So what we're talking about, again, is like certain functions of the state are being automated. That said, you know, human social life is extraordinarily complex, nuanced, and deep. You're not going to be able to put everything on the blockchain and negotiate, you know, like all these, you know, micro forms of social reciprocity through on-chain settlement. I mean, that's a big thing, on-chain settlement. Settlement as such, you know, as you were pointing out in your example of farm work, human relationships are this constant negotiation of credit, of interpersonal credit. You know, I have this kind of mental ledger of what I've done for this person, what this other person has done for me, and kind of where we're at, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down. Like, do they owe me? Do I owe them? You know, how much? And most of that stuff is never recorded. It's never quantified. Using a system of account or medium of account, it's never settled. And so this is actually what underpins like systems of morality, systems of religion, is, you know, people developing a metaphysics of debt, and, you know, how debts get paid over time and what is owed to whom, you know, things like filial piety, national patriotism, like do you owe your life to your nation? You know, are you going to sacrifice yourself for your children, like paying it forward versus settling debts? Like, all of these things become elaborated in a cultural tradition of values. And so my concern is that, you know, this, or what I'm trying to point out is that this moment of settlement of a financial transaction on a blockchain that Bitcoin has enabled is just like this teeny tiny part of human sociality, which is huge and deep and complex. And its advent alone doesn't mean that we've now solved politics.
It's this teeny tiny part that, because of the desire of the state to parasitically feed itself off of humanity, has grown to be a very large part. And when we take that away because of Bitcoin, then we can kind of go back to maybe the actual expression of what it means to be human. I still need my cousins. I still need my M4 and my 45. Because you're right. Like, you bring up such a great point. Like, this is all so individual and so interpersonal. When I go work cattle with my neighbor, they walk out and it's gentle and peaceful and they call the cattle and, you know, that's, you know, I'll do that for $50 or $100 or a steak. But if I go work with my uncle, you know, by the end of the day, somebody's going to be crying. Somebody's going to be bleeding. it's going to be a rough day. And you're right. Like, so it is all so individual and unique, that you're right. We're going to continue to have to adjudicate these interactions on an individual basis. Right. Oh, that's fantastic.
And we're reading Our Tribal Future right now by David Sampson. And one of the points he kind of makes as a throwaway point is that morality develops, evolutionarily speaking, we might say it develops once we get beyond relationships that we have family relationships, then we have friend relationships with our immediate kind of personal intimate collection of people around us. And then we get to bigger group relationships and we develop morality. I think you're saying as a way to kind of delineate the rules by which we're going to acknowledge that debts have been released. Like, morality develops exactly to outline in a sort of abstract way when you should accept something short of violence as settlement for a debt that you have incurred with somebody else or they've incurred with you or something like that, right? Like, is that what you're saying? Like, all of morality is based around this need to obviate violence by saying when you should accept debts being settled?
Yeah. I think morality is deeply imbued or organized around concepts of debt, of which things like guilt and shame are manifestations. You know, we feel guilty when we feel like we've wronged someone. We may feel like that creates a debt we have to them that must be repaid, or, you know, if not to them, then to God or to the ancestors or to the spirits or in, you know, whatever the metaphysical answer is to that. And this also, you know, becomes, you know, debt. The metaphysics of debt and guilt become modes of social control. You know, if you teach people that their originary state is one of debt, that, you know, everyone is born into a state of debt that they must then repay, that creates a set of beliefs around who I am in service to. Like, who is it that I existentially am in debt to? And what does that then require of me? And so, you know, going back to the Enlightenment, which was mentioned earlier, you know, one of the ways that the Enlightenment is sometimes criticized is because social thinkers during the Enlightenment started propounding this idea that man is good by nature, as opposed to evil and fallen. And, you know, Rousseau in particular, like, we often forget that he ran away from Calvin's Geneva. He was born and raised in a theology of, like, you know, the most absolute form of original sin and predestination. There's nothing you can do. You know, if you're damned, you're damned. And this clearly scarred him. This was something he was reacting to. And so he was, you know, in his theories of a state of nature, and the fact that humanity, you know, that children are born good, but they're corrupted by society. These were his ways of trying to work out an alternative theology of guilt and debt. And for the purpose of liberating himself and ultimately humanity.
I think Rousseau is one of Grant's favorite philosophers, if I remember correctly. No. Am I thinking differently? Okay.
You're thinking differently. Saying all the vaguely French sounding names.
No. So. How does this play with the you know, how does this play with the idea that if you're, you know, you're a Christian, you're born a sinner? So mm-hmm. is that, you know, that you're born in debt, and that this, you know, I'm not well versed in philosophy. And so I don't quite understand, but I can you kind of elucidate a little bit more about this? Because one of the things that I see more and more, especially among the Bitcoin community, is a draw towards religion, mm-hmm. is a draw towards specifically Christianity. Mm-hmm. And so can you kind of, I guess, can you tie those things together?
Yeah. So the question of sin and debt is a very, it's an extraordinarily deep and nuanced theological question. So it has been interpreted in countless ways within the Christian tradition itself, you know, let alone in other religious traditions. And so, you know, the question immediately arises of like, what is religion even? Is that a useful category of analysis? One of the ways that it has been defined is, you know, as what it is that binds you. Like what are the moral bonds that you are living your light in light of? So who do you serve? You know, do you serve God or do you serve Caesar? Do you serve, you know, this particular type of God or this particular version of God versus, say, another? And so I would suggest that the answer of what, like, sin and debt mean in Christianity is not a straightforward answer. And it's the outworking of people attempting to answer that question has in many ways been the engine of the history of Christianity itself.
But do you think Christianity is based on a notion of debt? Or are all religions an outgrowth of our need to have an internal social ledger and then feeling that we've accumulated some sort of debt by being born? Is that kind of the purpose that religion serves? Or like we're coming to the outside of our own choosing, owing it to something, and we've incurred a debt that we can never pay back? Is that the connection to religion possibly? Or
It's certainly been empirically the case that many religions have functioned in that way. So they have functioned as stories, institutions, and social relationships that answer the question of who is in debt to whom and what does that require of us. That said, religions are constantly undergoing reform. So every religion has within its history, if we can even use that word, perhaps tradition, let's say, every tradition has within its history processes and people who reinterpret the tradition or who sees on other parts of the tradition to challenge other parts of the tradition. And so it's this, there's a contestation within every tradition around, you know, what is being solved for and what our ultimate values are. And certainly within the Christian tradition, there have been many voices who have rejected notions of, let's say, original sin or some attempt to concretize that in, let's say, political quiescence, you know, that we just need to obey the authorities that, you know, we're born into, that they're all established by God, that there's no, you know, social contract or natural law or anything like that. I mean, the history of philosophy is in many ways the history of deeply religious people or people wrestling with religious mandates to ask questions about, you know, what is the good life? You know, what is liberty of value at all? If so, what does it mean for a human being to be free? What does it mean for a human being in relationship to their God to be free? And so I would, you know, much like I, you know, don't trust political labels like anarchism or, you know, leftism or rightism, I would be suspicious of believing that I understand what a religious person has to say concretely about notions of sin or death. That said, people use religion all the time as a justification for whatever their notions of sin or debt may be. And so this is the tension. Like, we have to think.
Yeah. And just to connect it back to your essay Towards an Anthropological Theory of Money, there's one part I think I might not have given enough significance the first time through that I think connects to this, where you discuss sacrifice, the kind of the cultural purpose of sacrifice in the context of how we consider, I think, the clearing of ledger to occur, that society that we have through many traditions, we arrive at a notion of expiatory sacrifice, where society invests a human or animal with vices or virtues and then ritually destroys it in a way that's supposed to wipe the social ledger clean. And then now right. We still continue to have notions of personal sacrifice, which maybe is like, as you're kind of now suggesting, an artifact of like our religious or traditional heritage. But is that correct? Or is how does the notion of sacrifice, I guess, fit into both the religious account and the account of the development of money?
Yeah, fantastic question. So sacrifices, practices of sacrifice, of destroying the victim in as a kind of payment to the spirits or the ancestors or gods, are ancient and pervasive across human societies. And, you know, the way that I think part of the revival, you know, today that we're seeing of like the thought of someone like René Girard is that he centers sacrifice in his theory of the social. So the book that I reference in this paper by Marcel Mauss and Henry Hubert was an early 20th century anthropological study of sacrifice, in which they made the claim that sacrifice demarcates the community because by specifying which people receive the benefits of the sacrifice. So, you know, we make the sacrifice on behalf of someone, humans, and the gods or God then repays them. So who is being repaid? Who is getting the human bounty? They are our community, political community, religious community, whatever. You know, what Girard proposes is that, you know, in some ways, Christianity is kind of like the sacrifice to end all sacrifice. And that it that is why it destroys myth, because the sacrifice of Christ sort of puts an end to practices of expiatory sacrifice, because there is one sacrifice that has occurred once and for all for the remainder of humanity. And so that it's almost a way, I mean, this is again a way of talking about debt, right? Your debt has been paid. Everyone's debt has been paid. And so this is why there's this tension within Christianity between that and, let's say, a concept of original sin. Like, and it's not straightforward. You know, have all of our debts been paid, or are we all born with originary debt that we then have to expiate in some way? And so these are some of the ways that the concept of debt gets worked out.
I feel like the focus is always on the, you're right. Like they're both within Christianity, but the focus is always within the, you're a sinner. And we completely forget, like, the tab has been paid. Like, yeah, you're good.
Right.
You know, yes, you owe, but you don't owe. you owed and now it's wiped clean. I really appreciate you going into that for us. That's
and
really helped out.
We need to cut a short of your explanation of René Girard's theories, because it's tough. I've read a lot of it, and that's the best, just like encapsulation quickly done of what he's getting at with sacrifice, because it sounds so ridiculous to say that sacrifice is at, kind of the core of a lot of what's happening nowadays, this kind of ancient ritual. But that's really fascinating. I had a question lined up based on that, but then Lucas.
I hear you.
It was this one because it's a ridiculous question.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. So talking about, you know, the nature of religion, its connection to Bitcoin. And so this figure of Satoshi, this figure who has disappeared, leaving unspent coins. I mean, what is the possibility that there's some sort of cultish or religious significance eventually given to this as somebody who's paid all of our debts by not paying his coins, by somebody who's sacrificed in a way that religiously significant sense of making this very costly refusal to distribute in his case, but that in some sense wiped the ledger clean for everybody?
Yeah. No, it's been so wonderful to see this play out because this is an ancient religious trope. Too, of, you know, the prophet or the deity that, you know, descends to earth and then removes itself. So like in Islam, there's this notion of the hidden imam, you know, that the one of the descendants of the prophet just disappeared one day and promised to return and has not returned. So I think it speaks to a kind of fundamental difference between the act of founding and then the institutionalization of what is founded. You know, there's a reason that, like, you know, often when a startup gets acquired or, you know, is scaling, the board or the acquiring entity fires the founders. Mm-hmm. Because they don't want that chaotic energy in something that is now they're trying to turn into a machine. And so, you know, like Max Weber, the sociologist, talked about the power of charisma, the charismatic leader, as fundamentally different from the power of bureaucracy. So the leader is charismatic, the founder is charismatic, but in order for the institution they found to endure, the predominant type of power that exerts needs to at some point transition from the charismatic authority to the bureaucratic authority, which is all about routinization and predictability and standardization, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's this tension in religious life. And when a tradition or a community is in a moment of crisis, often what that points to is that the established institution can no longer contain the, let's say, either opposing forces of conflict, or it can't manage, it can't metabolize a new external reality that is disrupting it. And so we might need a moment of refounding, of renewal. And so you get religious reformers, you get splintering, you get perhaps the foundation of entirely new religions or political communities. Yeah, all of that came from your question.
I'm going to let you ask a question, but I just want to do a callback to the anthology that the first essay, What Satoshi Did, talks about a lot of that, the shift from a founder to somebody who sets the seeds for a social layer. The Bitcoin has a social layer that's been intentionally seeded that's going to take over and allow it to be more decentralized. And I just thought that was a fantastic essay by Bailey and Warnke. But
yeah.
You talk about in the epilogue and in your essay, the Fourth Amendment as being where we've really gone wrong in the last 50 years since the Bank Secrecy Act in 1970. And that in order to effectively have a refounding, that we will have to individually stand up for those Fourth Amendment rights. What do you see happening in the world today that is an example of that? Or who do you see that is making strides in that area, or is it a who, or is it simply a what, and the what being code that is enabling that?
Yeah. So the Bill of Rights as a whole is, it's this fantastic addition to the Constitution that was basically put in there by the anti-federalists to to again put limits on the power of the state. But you know, as we've seen over the last few centuries, we can't just trust the state to police itself, like to observe the limits that are in the Constitution. And so what happens? Well, society, non-state society, and specifically the individual, needs to have the power to enforce those limits, which means limits to the ability of government violence to encroach upon people's lives. And strong encryption is perhaps the clearest way in which the people are enforcing those limits today. This is why there are constant efforts to break encryption by governments. It never dies. You know, if there's one court case that rules against them, they're just going to keep going. They're going to keep bringing it to court. They're going to keep passing legislation. They're going to keep trying to capture judicial review to, you know, legitimize its constitutionality. And so there is a race between the power of the state and the power of the individual. And this is actually a point that Rothbard makes in The Anatomy of the State, is that times of great liberty and scientific progress are often eras in which the power of the individual seems to outpace the power of the state. And so the state then races to catch up, you know, as we've seen with the internet and social media and all of, you know, these recent phenomena in our era. And so we just have to stay ahead. We have to stay one step ahead of the state. That's the only way that we preserve our liberty.
I think, first off, I love how you smile and laugh when you start talking about these things, because you have such a passion for this, and you're obviously so well read, but to also enjoy it so much, I think is wonderful. Like, you know, that's why we do this, but it's so wonderful to see somebody talk. You know, we're not sitting around trying to be so serious about this.
And yeah,
it's the absurdity of the system that is what's being called out. You know, you point out, like, how ridiculous is it to have this idea that a state is in charge and they're also in charge of making sure that they're not doing things wrong? It's like, oh, no, right. Work. I'll watch me. And, you know, the idea of, like, just the absurdity of the creation of money out of nothing is like the idea that I need $1 million. Oh, I can just loan myself $1 million and then I can loan myself another $1 million to pay that off. And further down, like when we break down into the individual idea of like, I'm going to go out onto the road and I'm not going to speed, but the only person who is in charge of me not speeding is me.
Right.
Definitely going to speed. I'm definitely going to. You're down near Austin, which is becoming this epicenter of comedy, and it's becoming an epicenter of comedy because all of the people that are pointing out the absurdities of the system that we are living in have decided to gather there and take advantage of their right to free speech and to point out and to call out. I talk about this often when I teach about this, is like we have to remember that the court jester came from this place of being below reproach. Like they were the person who they were allowed to call out absurdity because they were so low that they couldn't be taken out. Not above reproach, you know, like the state, but below reproach. I enjoy your passion about this. Like it's really God, it's just so refreshing to not to to talk with somebody who is excited about this, but in a way that shows joy and show. So I guess my question then would be like, you're obviously happy about this. There's things about this that make you feel good. What are you really optimistic about as we go forward? Like, what is your view? And I have to relate this. I heard this quote yesterday about Jewish people, that the optimists are the ones that died in the gas chambers. The pessimists are the ones that have houses in Beverly Hills, because they were like, we're getting the hell out of here. Like, oh no, we can stay, like, this will be all right. You know, we can work this out. We can talk. And this goes back to, you know, Balaji's, voice, exit, or loyalty. And you appear to be advocating more for voice rather than exit, but while taking advantage of the abilities that code allows us to exit some of the abuses of the state. So yeah, like what are you optimistic about? Like what are you looking at that is giving you this joy about the world?
I think honestly, I've just lengthened my timeline. I've become a lot more low time preference with regard to politics, the science of society, human moral reform. The more impatient you are, the easier it is to be unhappy. And it also, that impatience can also become an excuse for not doing what is yours to do, because you want to see results right now. And so if taking responsibility for something means you're not going to see results ever, perhaps, you know, your grandchildren will see results, or, you know, people in five centuries will see results. That may be a roadblock to a lot of people. And so I think just like a certain level of maturity has helped me accept what I can and can't control, and then to take responsibility for the things I can control, to build a better world that I may never see.
What role does technology play in that? Because I, and Grant and I were talking about this again, like the, one of the things that gives us anxiety, one of the things that gives us the desire for instant results is using technology, is scrolling through through social media and wanting instant gratification. It's, I'm hungry, so I'm just going to tap a button and have food delivered to me instead of making it myself. Have you found yourself moving away from certain forms of technology, or even kind of technology writ large, but for the benefits that code grants you in order to more fully express your God-given rights? Like how has your day-to-day life changed as a result of taking on this new outlook on life?
Yeah. I think it's been, a huge part of this has been spiritual renewal and spiritual discipline. Candidly, like, the recognition that it is, if you care about your soul, your character, one of the things that asks of you is to take existing institutions lightly, in this world, but not of it. And that means stepping back from the desire for short-term pleasure and power. So, I grew up in a full celebrity culture, like that was kind of the model of success. I was put through some very competitive educational gauntlets, you know, fully elite stuff in the Ivy Leagues, like we're raising you to take the reins of power, blah, blah, blah. Achieving power is the most important thing. And you may not even realize the extent to which you've absorbed some of this stuff until you're older and you realize, oh, I'm spending a lot of my time on social media. I'm really, you know, fixated on politics. I'm really fixated on wealth or money or whatever. And so there comes a point and optimally this isn't something that ends. This point just becomes the beginning for a moral revolution in the life of the person, where you begin to question the values that you hold, and begin to intentionally choose your values. And that is recognition of the extent to which you have agency. And it can be terrifying because it also means you have responsibility. You have to be the site of the love and the justice and the truth that you want to see in the world. And that doesn't mean getting a huge audience of followers necessarily. It doesn't mean getting political power. It could mean those things, but it is not those things. So continuing that moral evolution is, I think, the most hopeful thing there is.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. And yeah. I mean, I know that we're all grateful that you did run through that educational gauntlet and that you're now sharing all of that. It reminds me somewhat, I don't know if this, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like it shares an ethos with your epilogue to this about the importance of peer-to-peer interactions, like that the interactions we have among people, forming civil society through face-to-face conversations, direct exchanges with others. It reminds me of, there's a philosopher, Emmanuel Levinas, who had the idea that morality springs as such from the face-to-face encounter, that when you come to people and encounter them and all of their richness, that you just kind of imparted like a commandment, I will not murder. You know, you just like coming in contact with other people is so spiritual in and of itself. And that peer-to-peer exchange has that. And Lucas and I have just been coming back to the idea that with Charlie Kirk's assassination, and one of the things he did was met with people face to face. It was to get out of the digital, to get out of that sort of abstract interaction, and to meet people where they were, and to try to have a peer-to-peer interaction. It was kind of attenuated because there were cameras and things like that, but it's just such a beautiful epilogue. And I guess, is there something about the face-to-face encounter as such, psychologically, that builds in us this idea of civil society that's irreplaceable as a form of peer-to-peer interaction?
Yeah. In some of the social scientific literature, psychological literature especially, the term relating is used, like relating to another person, actually being present as yourself and interacting with them as they are, in the context of the true situation that you both find yourself in and what you both are solving for in that situation. There are many different kinds of truth, but that is a form of relational truth that arguably predicates our ability to think other kinds of truth, like more cognitive kinds of truth. Because if you're constantly performing for yourself or you're inauthentically being with others, you develop habits of mind of untruth that can then seep into other areas. And so, there is a primary truth that is encountered when, you know, we are with other people, unmediated by screens or media or even institutions, let's say forms of authority and control. And there's something holy about that, perhaps even, you know, that some religious traditions, in Christianity, there's this notion of the kingdom of God, you know, it is among you. And so the question is, like, can we be sites of that?
Can we, what was that? Can we be?
Can we be sites of that? Can we be
the place that arises? That's great. Yeah. So the peer-to-peer interaction is potentially an interaction in which we can all become sites of the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
That's a profound vision of civil community for sure. That's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it ties in, I think, to what you're doing with, I mean, you've created a 501c3, the Texas Bitcoin Foundation, a 501c6 trade association, the Texas Blockchain Council, also building like civil society in that space between private business and public governance. There's a third sector, which is kind of nonprofit, which is NGO or just simply organizations that are not in it for money or for authority, but for the creation of some sort of project that's apart from those. And I guess the question would be something like, does Bitcoin need more of that? These public charities and trade associations, the creation of this sort of texture of a civil society that isn't private, isn't public, but serves as kind of a bulwark against both. And can Bitcoin play a role in that, I guess?
Yeah. You know, so long as Bitcoin or any other peer-to-peer technology can maintain their independence from institutional capture, they can serve as infrastructural rails for a civil society that flourishes without the state.
I want to follow up on that. So I have this quote that keeps running through my head ever since I heard it, just the question of, if your government can create money out of nothing, then what is the purpose of them taxing you? Like, why do you need to tax me if you can just make it? And so I also think about that as it applies to charitable organizations, which are, you know, they're a tax classification. They're a way to get around. In a world where Bitcoin is prevalent and, you know, let's say it does become, the main source of value, or the main medium of exchange and value. You know, I guess my take on this is that the ability of a nation state to be coercive is going to dramatically fall, because the ability of them to tax people, A, through taking their money, but B, through inflating away their money by printing, both of those abilities are going to precipitously fall. And so in a world where I think taxation is much less of a instrument of keeping governments alive, because they simply can't, you know, you can't take my Bitcoin. I have to give it to you. Where do tax exempt organizations, because charity exists without a tax classification. I can be charitable. I can do things out of the goodness of my heart. I don't need, and in fact, even before Doge came around and started, you know, shining a light on all of these NGOs and showing us the, you know, 99.9% of the money never gets to the end goal in the majority of these organizations, I had seen that beforehand in working with some. Mm-hmm. And so what do you see? I mean, yes, you're working within this system with these tax exempt classification vehicles that you've put together, but where do you see the future of that part of the the world. You know, like if we don't need to have tax exempt organizations for the people to hide their money away from the taxes that are merely meant there to parasitically suck off the people that just can't afford the lawyers and can't afford meandering through the legal system to do it. You know, what is the future of charity and charitable organizations? I keep waiting for you to say that's a dumb question, because you've been very generous in saying that's a great question. And I keep waiting for that's a dumb question. I'm gonna get one sooner or later.
No, I think you're asking big questions, like really big ones. And I like that. So charity. Charity and non-profit oriented work, it exists in tension with both the state and economically productive, let's say profit motivated organizational forms. I guess it is constrained only to the extent that civil society itself is constrained. And so if civil society is facing increased predatory pressure from the state, then the sphere and the scope of charity will likely also diminish. And so it is in the interests, I think, of civil society to always be exerting pressure against the predation of the state, especially via taxation. The Rothbard has this great quote again, production precedes predation. So the state is always predatory on the productive capacity of civil society, and ultimately of individuals. And so we have to keep insisting on the conditions for that productivity. And if we exist simply to be farmed, that is over time going to destroy the very conditions of productivity that the state preys upon. And this is one of the engines of state collapse, which we see again and again in history. The ruling elites end up overtaxing. They end up basically eating into the economic seed corn of their society, and then it can't support them. There comes a point at which they become vulnerable either to civil war or to invasion, external invasion. And so our economic generativity enables not only a robust charity ecosystem, but actually enables a kind of political stability. A ruling class that does not exceed its bounds can continue to rule. And so this is the paradox.
Yeah. Nonprofit can't exist without profit, because it requires profit to run nonprofit, which the way that yep. you're thinking about it, you know, just hearing it, you know, that predation or production precedes predation, is that now I'm looking at, you know, charities and NGOs as nothing more than, you know, predatory on profit. And a guy like Elon Musk has like very famously, like, not a big fan of charities, because he's like, look, the most charitable thing that I can do is continue to, you know, provide goods and services that better humanity. That's way better than me hosting $100,000 a plate dinner in order to give, you know, sandwiches to Eskimos or whatever it might be. I had this experience when my previous life, when I was a banker, and I was just miserable. And, I lived across the street from a single mother and she had a couple kids, and, I, the way that I pulled myself out of being miserable was one day I just walked over and I knocked on her door and I asked if I could take her kids on a bike ride, get them out of her hair for a little while. And then it became, you know, hey, can I, I've got an extra TV. I've got an extra couch, you know, can I just give this to you? And like that really opened my eyes to the true beauty of charity is that giving directly.
Yeah.
You know, it's this idea of going through an intermediary, you know, so many people work for charities and there's so many people that need charity and they don't seem to, it doesn't seem to be that a linear increase in charities and people working for charity decreases the need for charity.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh. Yeah, I appreciate the way that you're thinking about these things and the way that you're explaining them, because it's something that if I were not having this conversation that I would want to listen to, the way that you are framing these things. Grant, save me.
No, well, I have a question based on that. And this is actually, I mean, the last thing on my list of questions, although I could have append an infinite number more, but it's the quote from the end of your introductory essay. You say, "We hope these essays will serve as invitations to think further, to build a community of good faith interlocutors, participating in the shared project and transforming science into new tradition, enabling a self-sovereign future for humanity at large." And just to dial in on one of those phrases, building a community of good faith interlocutors. I mean, it goes back to what we've been talking about, the peer-to-peer interactions, the conversations we have, building civil society. Where does that best occur? We have Twitter is kind of somewhat decentralized medium, but there's still an algorithm. It's still corporate. The academy doesn't seem like a great place for a lot of these dialogues to take place. The Satoshi Papers, the book itself is one solution that you could have an independently, you know, a set of independent scholars come together, release something into the world, trigger conversations. But how do we continue to build, what's the best medium for that community of good faith interlocutors that's going to be kind of the necessary precedent condition for this refounding?
Yeah, I would say that it starts one-on-one. The best community of good faith interlocutors is you and another good faith interlocutor. And, you know, sometimes it's an achievement to just find one, like in your entire life. It's, you know, just like it can be an achievement to have like one great friend. And it builds from there. So I think what you guys are doing is very much on the right path. I mean, you're reading carefully, you're reading in good faith, and then you're inviting people into the conversation with you one-on-one in good faith. And I think that's where it begins.
I appreciate that. That's really nice, because I do feel like, I mean, that's, if I had to summarize why I wanted to do this, that would probably be some iteration of that, that I want to have a good faith dialogue and just have those conversations. So that's very nice. I appreciate that.
I don't have a watch. I'm not keeping track on time. Do I have time for a question?
We're good.
Yeah, if you have 2 hours, you have time for questions.
So one of the things that I wanted to ask was, I know that you got a lot of submissions for the Satoshi Papers, and so you obviously had to choose, you had to exclude some, and you don't have to like name anything specific in terms of like the individual contributor, but is there anything that, looking at it now, that you would want to include that you feel maybe was like an angle of attack or a topic of discussion that you feel now would warrant more discussion, would be deserving of having a place, or maybe there's a sequel comes out. So like, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, so the Satoshi Papers, it was originally envisioned as a journal, that would have regular editions.
Do it. Do it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we decided to make the first version a book in effect because we wanted it to be a beautiful collector's item that showcased a particular moment in the, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
The gold sided library edition with the nice red ribbon bookmark. It's very classy. It's a welcome addition to any bookshelf and a necessary addition to your bookshelf, to your Bitcoin bookshelf for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, we wanted it to be beautiful and classic. But it really has just gotten the conversation started from our point of view. And so, you know, we've been thinking through what the next steps might be, if it's another volume, if it's a series of papers, if it's, you know, conferences, what is it? But, you know, one of the things this volume focused on was political economy. Some of the issues that weren't treated, but that definitely merit discussion, have to do with political philosophy. So that is kind of a topic that I've been thinking through with some of my co-authors and with the board, and we'll see where it goes.
Nice. Yeah, the University of Wyoming just put out a call for papers, their Bitcoin philosophy unit or Bitcoin unit there.
Yep.
So. It's definitely a building movement to create this intellectual atmosphere and necessary conversation around Bitcoin. I mean, that's all I have. I don't know, Natalie, if you have anything that I can go ahead.
I've got one more.
Go ahead.
So we were both curious because you left your academic pursuit of a PhD in order to join this startup, but you were focusing on value and specifically on the sacred. And mm-hmm. So I wanted to hear from you, like, what drew you to that as a topic? And had you continued to pursue that, where do you think you would have, you know, where would that have taken you in terms of, like, what is value and what is sacred? I think we've probably covered, I define, you know, something that has value as something that is scarce and desirable. Mm-hmm. And maybe you've got a different definition, but I haven't really ever given a whole lot of thought to what is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm like really curious about what drew you to that topic, and what interested you there, and, you know, where would that road have led you to? Not professionally, but like in the terms of the research, like what is sacred, and mm-hmm. what are the things that are sacred that we should be taking note of and respecting and giving the time of our low time preference to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that drew me to this notion of the sacred is that it seemed to describe both the highest levels of, let's say, positive valuation, and the lowest levels of negative valuation. So there's an anthropologist named Mary Douglas who wrote a book called Purity and Danger about the kind of two-faced structure of the sacred in many societies where, you know, the thing that is considered the most pure, unbefiled, can also sometimes be treated as dirt, as pollution, as dangerous to the social order. And so it's a really interesting manifestation of valuation, because it's threatening at the same time as it appears to be the ultimate aim that is sought. Or that, you know, people in that social milieu are taught to strive toward or value. So like, you know, in the Christian tradition, there's this statement of the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, you know, the thing that was just like blasphemous has now become the underpinning of the edifice of a new religious tradition. And so I was very interested in that bipolarity, that duality of the sacred and what it says about continuity and change in human societies. Because often, you know, it's the institutions and the practices that seem, you know, the most sacred, seem like the unchangeable things, you know, the eternal things, well, of course we have a monarch, and the monarch is the vicar of God, and is anointed and, you know, self-evidently the authority. But yet that concept of the sacred becomes the very source from which that authority, that supposedly self-evident sacred authority, is subverted. No, the believer is actually sacred. And perhaps there's a priesthood of the believers. Perhaps, in fact, the monarch is completely irrelevant to God's design, or God's plan. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. And so I found the sacred to be a provocative concept, and one that invites us to constantly unsettle what we think we know on the way to things that we know more deeply beyond the conventional wisdom of the time in which we live.
So on the journey that you've been on in your life, what is sacred? What's sacred in your life to Natalie?
I think first and foremost, each individual human person. I think that the fact of existence, that we are here, that each one of us is a total singularity. We cannot be combined or collapsed with anyone else. The uniqueness of our person and our calling in the world, like the sanctity of the human person, I think is something that, yeah, that I believe in deeply.
Nice. I'm glad that it's not a Taylor Swift album or a Beanie Baby.
Yeah. Connect deeply though to the work that you're doing. And I'm so happy that you did pursue your interest as far as it would go in the sacred. And just that now the way that you talk about religion and demystify its connection to the state without collapsing religion entirely, it's just great to hear you talk on that. And I hope, have you written or committed to essay form any of these insights on that you're talking about the nature of the sacred and the nature of its connection to the state and its abuse, etc.?
No, I haven't yet. But that is on the horizon. I'm seeking to become the person who can write those essays.
That's excellent. Yeah, that's really good. I love that formulation and that truth.
Yeah.
very good. Do you have any, we have 4 minutes before the 2 hours that you very generously gave us. We're very incredibly appreciative of that. Is there any thing you want to add, plea you want to make, something disjointedly you suddenly want to hawk, right? But anything you want to say before you're on Twitter, Natalie's on Twitter, follow her there. She's an excellent follow. But what else you got? Buy the Satoshi papers, obviously.
Yeah. And you know, there's an ebook. The ebook is already out and it drops on Amazon on October 15th. So, nice. Yeah, but no, I think, you're not owned unless you let yourself be. So let's not be owned together.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Hit the end, man. Don't.
That is the end of our first hopefully of many discussions, not just on this topic, but also with Natalie Smolinski, the author of the Satoshi Papers, Reflections on Political Economy After Bitcoin. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. For everyone watching and listening, please share with your friends. Consider us yours. We're all in this together. Thank you for joining us.